In the course of the preparation and reading, I ran across a man who stated this. It's not original with me, so I just wanted you to know that. But he expressed this, and it just captured my sentiments exactly. He said, "I feel like a man who's gone up into his attic to bring down some priceless antiques that no one has seen for a long while." I feel like that. When it comes to this subject of providence, I feel like I'm bringing down an antique, a priceless antique, for us to take a look at that people haven't looked at much. It's just been tucked away, stored away up there, and out of sight, but I get the privilege of bringing it down and showing it to you all over again. And beautiful and priceless it is. We're talking about providence, if you weren't here with us last week. It's a word that combines two Latin words, pro, which means before, and videre, which means to see beforehand. Of course, when it applies to God, it's talking about a huge thing, which we'll try to define for you a little bit tonight. Here's what Louis Burkhoff said, or this is the definition that he gave. Providence is God's continual activity in the world for the realization of his plan. He goes on to say, it is how God relates to the world that he created. Now guys, speaking of that world that he created and how God relates to it, I want to bring you some antiques that we probably haven't looked at quite, and we have to do this pretty fast because there's so much to be said. But this is in Psalm 65, beginning in verse 9. Now listen, remember, providence is how God relates to the world that he created. Well, here's a description of that. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers and blessing its growth. You crown the year with your bounty. Your wagon tracks overflow with abundance. The pastures of the wilderness overflow. The hills gird themselves for joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valleys deck themselves with grain. They shout and sing together for joy. That's an antique! We haven't looked at that very often. Did you see how it describes God's involvement with the world that he made? Folks, rain doesn't cause crops to grow. God does. Just a couple of quick more. This is Psalm 104, beginning at verse 14. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine and bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted, and then the birds built. Do you see, folks, how the scriptures are describing God's relationship to the world that he made? Here's one more. This is in Psalm 147, verse 14. He makes peace in your borders. He fills you with the finest of the wheat. He sends out his command to the earth. His word runs swiftly. He gives snow like wool. He scatters frost like ashes. He hurls down his crystals of ice like crumbs. Do you hear that? So what's his relationship to the world that he created? Oh no, just a very little. I mean, he's in charge of the snow and the ice and the rain and the plants and the meadows and the fields and the birds and the trees. You mean providence includes that? Yes, that's what I mean. That's what Burkhoff meant. Providence is a word that it is discussing how God relates to the world that he made. Let me show you one in the New Testament. And this is one that you know and love. Jesus is talking and he says, don't be anxious about your life, what you shall eat, nor about your body, what you will put on. For life is more than food and the body more. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor, they have neither storehouse nor barn. And yet God feeds them. Ravens. Birds. He goes on to talk about the lilies of the field. They spin, they don't spin, they don't toil, because God is involved in lilies. His providence includes lilies and ravens and ice and snow and wheat and crops. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, when you and I speak or think of or think about laws of nature, those aren't really laws of nature. They're merely human observations of how God normally orders and regulates his universe. Let me give you an example. Here's what we would call a law of nature. It's called photosynthesis. How plants take sunshine and turn them into whatever they turn them into. Well, we say, well, there's a law of nature called photosynthesis. No, folks. That's just a human title of how God orders and regulates his universe. Called photosynthesis. Miracles are things where God sets aside that normal ordering and where he intervenes supernaturally. But laws of nature are just observations as to how God does it. We just attach words to things that God is intimately associated and acquainted with. Guys, we sing a song around here that I absolutely love, and I think you do too. It's called Great is Thy Faithfulness. And in the hymn, we sing it. But we never, it's just an antique that passed right through our hands and we never paused to think. Summer and winter and springtime and harvest, sun, moon, and stars in their courses above. What is that? But a recognition of God's intimate governance of the world that he created. Summer and winter and seasons and suns and stars and ravens and lilies and corn and wheat and furrows and meadows and all of it is under the governance of a provident God. Guys, let me show you a couple of statements in the New Testament concerning his providence. And I, again, it is my privilege to show you an antique. Acts chapter 4. This is right after Peter had been arrested and the Sanhedrin beat him up and they finally let him go. And when they were released, they went to their friends and reported what the chief priests and the elders had said to them. And when they heard it, they lifted up their voices together. Sovereign Lord, who made the heavens and the earth, we're praising you, etc. Now, for truly, this is what they say. For truly in this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. Listen, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Oh, so it's not just the ravens and the lilies and the fields and the corn and the rain and the snow and the sleet, huh? It's Pilate and Herod and all the Gentiles. Simply accomplishing that which was providential under the sovereign superintendence and governance of God. You know, another one in Acts that I love, I used it at a funeral one time and I still am moved by it, not by my sermon, but by the text. In him we live and move and have our being. Ladies and gentlemen, think about that. How'd you get over here? Did you move on over here, did you? You got a little being going on, do you? Good. In him we live and we move and we have our being. Because the God to whom we belong is a God that governs things top to bottom. Guys, last week I told you a story. I told you a story about me. I love to talk about me. My best stories are about me. I told you a story about, you know, the playing football and Osgood Slaughter and Vietnam War and airplanes and almost killing myself on the runway at Chattanooga and then taking the oath of office. I was a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force and then was washed out because of Osgood Slaughter. I told you that whole story, and I told you that from the reason that I busted up my knee when I was 8 years old playing overhead tackle at Gary Guy's front yard was because God was governing. I told you that story, and then I said to you, you know, you all have stories, but not just one story. You got three or four stories. You got 10 or 12 stories. And many of you have stopped me to tell me your stories. So could you stop telling me your stories? You know, I got a little work to do back here. we all have stories. But I want to tell you another story, but not about me. I want to tell you a story about one of my heroes. It's in here. And you know what? All of you know this story. It's a great story. It's a story about Joseph. Remember him? He was the youngest of those sons of Jacob, and he would come in, and his father gave him this fancy coat, like he didn't give his brother. You know, his brother didn't like that, so the brothers, and then he told the brothers this dream that he had about all the stars and the moon bowing down to worship him. You know, how about that? That wasn't very smart. But the brothers didn't like that, and so they cooked up this scheme to kill him. So they threw him into a little pit, you know, and they thought, well, we'll just let some tiger eat him or something. But they said, no, let's just sell him to this Egyptian caravan that's moving on down there. So they got him out of the pit, and they sold him. He goes down to Egypt, and he gets bought by Potiphar, as you recall. In this marvelous story, you remember just a story? Just one of those things that you use in Bible study to keep the kids calm and entertain them, you know? Well, there's Joseph down there, and there's Potiphar's wife trying to seduce him, and, you know, he's trying to run from her. But Potiphar got home from work, and she tells a lie, and he gets thrown into prison. And it's not good down there in those Egyptian prisons, I can only imagine. But then a couple weeks later, the baker and the cupbearer, they got thrown in the same prison. They have some terrible dreams. I wonder where those dreams came from. Oh, what a wonderful coincidence that Joseph was down there to tell them about their dreams. Well, you're going to be elevated back up, but you're going to die. And that's what happens. My. Isn't that just fortunate that Joseph could figure that all out? And then, you know, this Pharaoh has a bad dream. Couldn't sleep one night. And so he's saying, somebody interpret this dream for me. And they say, could you do something about the message on the board there? Just set a piece of dynamite under this thing. That should do it. So we got this. The Pharaoh's got a dream. Got a dream. And nobody can interpret the dream. And so the cupbearer says, oh, yeah, you know, well, I remember there was this guy, and he's down there because, you know, he was not a good boy with Potiphar's wife. But he interpreted dreams. And Pharaoh says, well, call him right up here. So he comes up there, and Pharaoh tells him the dream. And he says, well, you know, I got these seven skinny cows, and the seven skinny cows ate up the big fat cows. So Joseph says, well, I got that one. What's going to happen here is, that we're going to have 7 years of plenty, and then we're going to have 7 years of famine. Go ahead, Dave. What do you do? Somebody give him a raise. I knew how to do that. Okay. I just forget the story. Let's close in prayer. You're going to have seven good years of plenty, and then you're going to have 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, well, my gosh. I mean, if you're that smart, we're going to let you run this whole thing. So they elevate him to the right hand of Pharaoh. Nobody is as strong in Egypt except Pharaoh. It's the only boss he's got is Pharaoh. So he runs the whole place and ends up owning everything. And then, his brothers who sold him into slavery and the daddy are starving up in Canaan, and they got to have some grain. And so they come down there, get some grain. He sticks this thing in their back. Oh, no, he gave us our money back. We got to go back. And so Joseph this whole time is hiding from them. And then finally one day he says, I'm Joseph, your brother. And that they were glad to see him, I guess. it really wasn't a good moment for him. And then, so they hug and kiss and, they make up and they put him in the Goshen land and everybody's having fat cows and having a big time. And then Jacob gets close, that's daddy. Jacob gets close to dying. It's about time for Jacob to die. That's not good. Why not good, Jimmy? Well, because the boys thought when daddy dies, Joseph is going to come get us. Joseph is going to, he's going to take care of us then after daddy dies. And so they come to him and they say, listen, daddy told us to you not to kill us. That's not exactly what the text says, but don't you be nice to us. And Joseph says, you misjudge me. I don't intend to harm you. Because don't you see that God, that you meant this for evil, but God meant, God meant this. God meant this for good. What do you mean he meant it? The same thing it means when it's talking about the boys. You meant it for evil. That is, you had a plan. You had a scheme. But you couldn't carry yours out. But God has had a plan from all eternity. And God meant this. He meant it for good. What do you think that word says, ladies and gentlemen? Let me tell you what it says. It says providence. That God governs the world that he created. Guys, I want to close, kind of, sort of, by giving you, I want to read you something. And this whole thing that is, it's completely designed to show you this word, or this concept at least, in numerous other places in the scriptures. Because all of these things bring you face to face with God's providence. Providences that we didn't think were too pretty. Or providences that we, I don't get that. I don't get it. Listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't write this. This is brilliant. So you can know that I didn't write it. He starts with a quote from Jeremiah 10. Here's the quote from Jeremiah 10. I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself. that it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. Do you hear that? I know that the way of man is not in himself. That it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. Oh, man proposes, but God disposes. That's what Proverbs 16, we talked about that last week, that man plans, but God ordains. Folks, this was not an accident. Beginning all the way back in Genesis 39, that this text takes place in chapter 50. But we're introduced to Joseph in chapter 39, and he's having dreams back in 39 about, well, you know, the 12 of the moon and stars are going to bow down and worship. I don't want to do that. It was his brothers. Where'd he get that? Oh, what a strange thing. Do you know where it originated, ladies and gentlemen? From the heart of a provident God. Because you see, the way of man is not in himself. That it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. Jeremiah here acknowledges the sovereignty and dominion of the divine providence, that by it, the affairs both of nations and particular persons are directed and determined. So there's one other fool in the world that believes this. This guy. Along with me. I'm the fool, by the way. Okay. Now stay with this, ladies and gentlemen. Gird up the loins of your mind. Wake up. This is as priceless an antique as you're going to hear from this podium in a long time. Ultimately, God is controlling the path we take. God raises up Pharaoh to prominence and orders him to let his people go, and then hardens his heart so that he will not do so until the appropriate time. When Joshua goes into battle, God hardens the hearts of Israel's enemies to resist them, and I'm quoting from Joshua 11, in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy but be destroyed. So this whole battle that Joshua's entering into, who's behind it? Eli's rebellious sons would not listen to him because, listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, this is an antique that you haven't looked at in decades. Eli's rebellious sons would not listen to him because, quoting 1 Samuel 2:25, it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Woo! I didn't know he did that. That's because that antique's been sitting up in the attic way too long, ladies and gentlemen. Way too long. Gosh. Well, I mean, there's more. David's son, Absalom, failed to defeat his father completely because he followed poor advice rather than good. Why? 2 Samuel 17:14. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. So that ain't a raven and that ain't a lily. That's not snow, it's not frost, it's not sleet, it's not hail, it's not corn. It's not a meadow, it's not a tree. It's a man. So what does he do? What does he use Ahithophel to do? He uses Ahithophel to give bad advice to Absalom. Why? It says right there. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. So there's Ahithophel, you know, kind of strutting around in the courtyard. Absalom, you want some advice from a smart guy? Here it is. Let me give you some advice from, you know, Mr. Counselor here. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, great. Thank you, Ahithophel. Let's go do that. And Absalom ended up in the fork of a tree, suspended by his hair, where he was killed by one of the soldiers of David. So that the Lord might bring harm against Absalom. Likewise, Solomon's son, you remember that? Solomon dies, he's got that son, Rehoboam takes over. And you remember the story? Rehoboam is just thinking, what am I going to do now that I'm a king? And then his older counselors come to him and say, well, listen, your daddy's pretty hard on these people, and so you need to kind of back off a little bit and speak nice to him, and they'll serve you forever. And he said, well, that's really good. I appreciate that. Any more counsel out there? Oh, yeah, the young guys came. Oh, their young guys come. And he said, listen, you go tell those guys, you go tell them that your little finger is stronger than your daddy's thigh was. And you tell them, that your daddy used to discipline you with whips, but I'm going to discipline you with scorpions. Yeah. So he says, well, let me weigh those two. So he comes back the next morning and says, okay, I'm taking the young guy's advice. Why do you want to do that? Solomon's son, Rehoboam, followed advice, oppressed the people, and thereby destroyed the kingdom. Yet we are told, 1 Kings 12:15, it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord. Have you looked at that antique lately? It's a beautiful antique. Because this provident God is your Father in heaven. The one that fills our coffers and our truckloads with grain. I got one more. The God that ordered circumstances from the moment that Joseph had a multicolored coat on him, putting dreams in his head, because he was his brother's. They weren't being good boys with their plan, but God meant it. He meant it. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about you. I can't speak for you. But I don't want a God, personally, who can't govern his universe. Because the God that is described in that book, and very frankly, he's the only one that exists. The God that is described in that book is described as good. And he is described as willing to be reconciled to the undeserving folk like us. And that God is in charge of all human affairs. One last thing. The 10 kings of Revelation give their kingdom to the beast because, Revelation 17:17. Let me read that. The 10 kings of Revelation give their kingdom to the beast because, here it comes, God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. All of you who are so concerned about the election next year and that the culture is absolutely decaying, well, it is, and you should be worried. But ladies and gentlemen, the 10 kings of Revelation give their kingdom to the beast, the beast, the bad Antichrist guy who's wreaking havoc everywhere, like here in the United States. And why? Well, God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God could be fulfilled. So that beast is running around wreaking havoc. He's just doing the bidding of God. And when his words are fulfilled, he'll be done. Folks, these are descriptions of a God in whose universe there is not one maverick molecule. Now that's a God that we can worship for an eternity. Let's quit. Our Father, would you take these truths from your word and make them real and understandable for your people to the point that you become much, much larger in their hearts and souls than you have ever been before. Might that happen? Might that occur in my soul, O God? When Mary says, "My soul doth magnify the Lord," might he be magnified tonight? Might he be bigger than he was when we got here? Might you be bigger than you were when we arrived? Might we leave here with a sense of being awestruck by a God who takes Herod and Pilate and all the Gentiles, and they do exactly what he had planned for them to do. Because you see, they meant it for evil. But you, O God, meant it. You meant it. You meant it for good. And good it is. We worship you, O God, in the name of Christ Jesus this evening, and pray that you would make us smaller and you larger. For Jesus' sake, we pray in his name. Amen.